Scott, your host, Mark Shea. And we are here today on this fine Wednesday afternoon with Rod Bennett. Rod Bennett is the author of a number of books. He's the author of The Apostasy That Wasn't, the author most recently of The Popcorn Cathedral, as well as other fun stuff. Former editor of Wonder Magazine, raconteur, Southern gentleman. I'm going to guess even a fisherman. I don't even know that.
Alas, I'm afraid that's not the case. I wish I could say. I wish I could say it is. My grandfather tried to teach me, and I'm just too dumb to get it, I guess.
This didn't pan out. Well, that's all right.
I have a profound admiration for those who practice that fine art.
It's an art. Yes, it is. Yeah. Well, of course, the key to learning how to fish is to remember that actually catching a fish is... it's a minor part of
somewhat incidental.
It is. It's somewhat incidental. The real reason for fishing is just to be out there, you know, and savoring the goodness. And
It's like fishing. It's like a ball game, and it's like golf. It's really just kind of an excuse to be outside on a nice day.
Yes.
But you've got a reason. If somebody should accuse you of wasting time or, wandering around doing nothing. No, you're playing golf. You're trying to catch fish.
That's right. Well, you know, and this, of course, the brand new rationale for doing this is Pokemon Go.
fishing for Pokemon.
Show a little. I mean, I was seeing this. I think Pokemon Go is a great idea because it gets people who have like spent their whole lives indoors staring at little square cell phones to go outside and walk around.
Yep, the world is your video game now.
Yeah, and so these people are, you know, and I go outside now and I'm seeing like little clusters of people walking down the sidewalk, all looking at their cell phones, and I'm going, oh look, it's a Pokemon pod,
you know, chasing an invisible animal. It's like Jimmy Stewart in Harvey.
Harvey,
isn't that great?
Yes,
the world could do worse right now than to have. A whole lot of country full of Harveys walking around.
Pokemon are, you know, yes, they're fond of rum pots, crack pots, and how are you, Mr. Wilson? But my favorite moments in that whole movie. But, I got no objections to it. The only thing that, you know, I've been sort of astonished in the last couple of days to see notices being put up saying, don't play Pokemon Go in the Holocaust Museum.
Well,
don't
that too, yeah.
Down in Arlington National Cemetery playing.
Yeah, I heard a story about the Flight 93 memorial earlier today. People looking for Pokemon.
Yeah, just show a little dignity, you know? I mean, show some respect. But beyond that, I mean, if you're out there wandering around in your, you know, city burg and stuff, knock yourself out. I'm glad you're getting some exercise. It's good for you. So,
well, there's certainly a lot less innocent things you could be wandering around looking for. So,
well, indeed, yeah. It's like, okay, this is weird, you know. So, it'll be interesting to see how much more augmented reality becomes,
to say the least.
Yeah, because I mean, why not? You know, why not from there? You know, I mean, you could have like you can put anything on that screen, so you could have giant dragons out there and all kinds of other cool stuff. You know, that would be pretty fun.
One of my many half finished science fiction stories is a story about. Well, it involves, at any rate, it's not necessarily about it, about the way in which virtual reality brings about the end of civilization.
Oh.
And it's connected with atheism. In other words, if virtual reality ever got anywhere close to virtually real, in other words, so that you just couldn't really tell the difference between the world inside the computer and the world outside, then that's an incredible temptation to humanity. It's a temptation not only to spend too much time in it. That's just the beginning of it. The temptation is to make that your life.
Well, right. In
other words, it's much easier to manipulate pixels than it is to manipulate atoms.
Okay.
In other words, you can get rich easier and quicker in a virtual world than you can in the real one.
Oh, well, okay.
You can woo partners made of pixels easier than you can partners made of atoms.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's no responsibility. In other words, if you go into a chat room, it can literally look like a chat room, and everybody's got their customized avatar of what they would like to look like.
Uh-huh.
And but if you get angry with somebody, you can just kill them. There's okay. there's no consequences because it's just pixels, right?
Right, right.
But eventually, it degenerates into skepticism about the superiority of atoms over pixels.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, why bother to explore space or the universe or any of these other things when who's to say that atoms are more real than pixels?
Mm-hmm.
If you see where I'm going.
Yeah, I can see.
In other words, it's a really kind of an ultimate denial of creation, the idea that a world exists outside of our minds and that it has a superiority to the ones we create inside our minds.
Mm-hmm.
It's a sort of an obligation to inhabit the world God made.
Yeah.
Because he made it and put us in it rather than
That's interesting.
Creating a new one that we made.
I was thinking of sort of the opposite. I was thinking of sort of a Chestertonian comedy, I guess. I was imagining, you know, somebody who's really just lived, you know, in this virtual world forever, you know, discovering Pokemon Go, and then for the first time in ages, setting foot outside the door. And going out into the real world, you know, leaving his mom's basement and going out into the real world to play this. And then having the thought occur to him that, you know, this three-dimensional realware that I seem to be in the middle of seems even more intriguing. It's more intriguing in this virtual world that I wonder what happens if I just leave the virtual world and go out into this experience of, you know, three-dimensional trees and people and actual things out there.
Well, that's the really sad thing is that it takes the imaginary Pokemon to get you to the Grand Canyon. You know? It was there all along, but you needed the Pokemon to give you an excuse or...
Well, yeah, any port in a storm.
You know? I guess so. Interesting.
But it's been kind of fascinating to see people stepping out a little bit and, you know, getting out and getting some. I'm a firm believer in the virtues of walking. The diabetes diagnosis a couple of years ago, they said, here, you need to take this stuff, which will help lower your blood sugar, and then you need to exercise. And for me, exercise means walking because I'm not one of those guys. I couldn't afford like a Nautilus thing. And besides, I just like the walking. So I go out and I walk a lot. Yeah.
Walking is good.
Yeah. So plus I love my wife likes my legs. So,
you know, it's no coincidence, I suppose, that, C.S. Lewis and Tolkien and all of that group we think of as the Inklings, mm-hmm. that was their hobby was walking.
And, walking,
Tolkien and Lewis met on a walk, an evening walk around Addison's Walk, a pathway at Magdalen College in Oxford. And I've made a couple of laps around that myself, and that was auspicious. That was their first meeting, really, was that night. And they walked around talking about God that Lewis didn't believe in at the time. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Hilaire Belloc, the good friend of Chesterton, was quite the walker. Walked from St. Louis to San Francisco in like 1906 when it was pretty much the Old West.
And yes.
Then he walked from his birthplace in France to Rome one time. And,
really?
Oh, that's a great story. He made a pact with himself to walk from his birthplace to Rome, and he made rules for himself setting out. He'd try to hear Mass every morning along the way.
Okay.
He would employ no wheeled vehicle, so resist temptation to hitch a ride on a wagon or a locomotive or any of the other things going on, and just walk to Rome. And it's a great story because, you know, I mean, this is in the days when he could sleep in a haystack, you know, along the way, and without any serious danger of crime.
Right.
And he was an artist, so he would go into little establishments along the way, inns and things like this, and draw for his supper. And so he would draw somebody's caricature or draw a landscape and get a bowl of soup out of the deal. So,
oh, that's pretty cool.
Anyway, all of this is recounted in his book, The Path to Rome, which is a cool book.
What a romantic thing to do, you know?
It is super romantic.
That's just super romantic thing to. I wish I had done something like that when I was that age, you know.
Belloc was quite a linguist. He was multinational. His father was French and his mother was English, mm-hmm. and so he knew French and English equally fluently. He also had a smattering of several other European languages, but one language he didn't know was German. And so when passing, you know, if you're going to walk from France to Italy, it involves going through Switzerland. And Switzerland has, well, we pick this up. Oh. Come back.
Well, we're up against the break here, but we'll talk about Switzerland when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Rod Bennett, and we'll be back right after this.
You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
Hello, and welcome back to Lots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we are here today with Rod Bennett and, of course, our good friend Ludwig van Beethoven. And if you want to join the conversation, we actually got a call yesterday from my friend, Father Jacob. If you want to give us a call, you're at 1. Give us a call, 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. And we were – oh, and you can also tweet us at Breadbox Media. Before the break, we were talking a bit about Hilaire Belloc and his romantic travels around Europe and also to the United States. Chesterton came to the United States. Belloc came to the United States. Belloc came here because he was chasing a girl.
He was indeed, yeah.
It's another super romantic thing to do.
That's a great, great story.
Yeah.
Great story. Let me quickly finish the part about him in Switzerland, Belloc in Switzerland. Belloc, crossing through Switzerland, went through the French-speaking parts of Switzerland, where he did fine, of course, and was right at home. And but then when he passed into the German parts, he fared more poorly because he didn't know the language and, couldn't be quite as amusing to the patrons of the inns and stuff, and thereby con him out of a glass of wine or something like that. But so he was feeling pretty lonesome, and he finally noticed in one of these places that there was a Catholic priest sitting at one of the tables, and he went over and sat down next to him and struck up a conversation in Latin because one of the languages that Belloc knew was Latin and not German. So he and the German priest got along just fine in those days. The priest, I think, probably knew Latin a bit better than they do today. And they did just fine conversing in the language of Helvetica, which is Helvetica was the Roman name for Switzerland. So so there you go. Isn't that a great story?
I remember hearing somebody, I suspect this is an apocryphal story, but I love it anyway. There was a sign like somewhere near the Swiss and German and French borders. Apparently they converge or something on a mountainside. And in French it says, please do not pick the flowers.
And in German, it says, it is strictly forbidden to pick the flowers. And then I don't even know if there is a Swiss line. This is one of the reasons that I'm dubious that it's a apocryphal story. But anyway, you know, the whatever the local Swiss dialogue said, those who love the mountains leave them their flowers.
Pretty good. Pretty good. Yeah. Yeah,
so, that's pretty. I thought that was pretty funny. Well, it's funny. Go ahead.
No.
No, after you.
You first, my friend. My esteemed friend.
All right. One of the things that's interesting about Switzerland is that it had a kind of a Calvinist mood for a while, Calvin's Geneva. But then Francis de Sales, you know, famously said that he would shake the walls of Geneva with love, and undertakes this kind of Catholic re-evangelization.
Right. People often forget that that John Calvin was a Frenchman.
Right.
We associate him, you know, with I don't know, in the mind somehow, you don't think of that really, but Calvin was a Frenchman, and the parts of Switzerland that he conquered by the force of his intellect were the French-speaking parts of Switzerland. It's a little extension of the French culture. The French love abstract logic, which I suppose most people in their right minds do, but the French have special passion for it.
I had an interesting conversation one time with a guy. He's an American, but French extraction. Hardcore, you know, kind of Society of St. Pius the X, kind of, you know, hardcore Catholic. And anyway, we had lunch one time, and one of the things that he remarked was that the whole Tolkien thing of, you know, this sort of romantic fascination with fairy and you know, the realm of elves and all that kind of thing. He said, you know, the French just look at that and go, English romantics, what a bunch of dips, you know? Why do you care? There is no such thing, right? You know, French Catholics are like, look, there are angels and devils and humans, and there's God, and that's it. And don't drag in all this romantic mishmash of fairy tale creatures and she and all this. It just confuses everything.
Yeah. Obviously, we're painting in generalities here, but there's a great deal in what you say.
It was pretty funny. Yeah, it was I never really thought about it that way.
But two of our local heroes here in these Smoky Mountains of East Tennessee are, of course, Andrew Jackson and John Sevier, whose statue is in the U.S. Capitol. Yeah, John Sevier was the great pacifier of the Indians here in East Tennessee. It's not a very politically correct term these days. But strangely enough, the Indians absolutely adored Sevier. They adored him better when he beat them than when, because they loved military virtues more than anything. But that's another story. Okay. But Sevier was a French Huguenot by nature, by extraction.
Okay. Whereas, what a fitting name.
Yes. And the Jackson, of course, was Scotch-Irish to his back collar button, with an emphasis on the Irish, probably. Ulsterman. Mm-hmm. His parents were born in Ulster.
Right.
And he had, of course, all of the the usual traits of the Ulsterman, the fierce fighting Protestantism, along with the, you know, the kind of... I don't know what the very high sense of honor and all the rest of it, but which is I got him into so many duels.
Right. And but, he hated the English with the burning passion of a thousand suns.
Although interestingly, it's funny you should bring that up. Okay. He was fairer probably to the English as president than many other presidents had been up to that time. Absolutely. He, you know, obviously just being from, you know, being from Northern Ireland was enough to get a lot of people incensed against the English, but also, of course, he has lost both his mother and brother to the deplorable dungeon that they were put into by the British Army during the Revolution.
Well, and he bore scars from a British saber too.
Yeah, being not slashed but struck across the face with the flat of the sword.
Yeah,
because he wouldn't polish the officer's boots. So
yeah.
So yes, he did have a bit of a
grudge.
A bit of a grudge. Yeah, and of course he got the ultimate revenge. He defeated Wellington's veterans from the Napoleonic Wars at New Orleans in the climactic battle of the War of 1812. Killed something like 2,000 Englishmen at the cost of, I think, 18 Americans.
Yeah.
So it's quite the revenge.
The second Revolutionary War.
Strangely enough, though, the English liked him better than most other American presidents when they actually dealt with him as president. But I suppose we could talk a lot more. But what I wanted to point out was that the two great local heroes of East Tennessee, John Sevier, the French Huguenot, and Andrew Jackson, the Ulsterman, did not get along. Uh-huh. Politically, they didn't see eye to eye. Sevier was a Federalist, and Jackson was a Democrat, and or what was known as a Republican Democrat in those days.
Okay.
Democratic Republican. And the two of them came very close to having a knife fight in the middle of downtown Knoxville on one memorable occasion, and had it broken up by their partisans on either side. So it's a very, very colorful story, to say the least. But the French and the Celtic temperaments kind of butted heads right there. Although I guess the Celts come from France originally too. So
that's true. Actually, the Celts come from Asia Minor originally. I remember a priest that I know saying, you know, the people who got the letter to the Galatians were the ancestors to the Celts.
How about that?
And he said,
pretty interesting.
So the advice is, you know, some of the moral advice about, you know, stop drinking and quit your blood feuds, you know. It's
like, yes, it's gone unheeded through the century.
It's all still there, you know. But
interesting stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very interesting stuff. But those are those issues of blood and race, I suppose they're very touchy and sensitive these days, but most of these kind of things have at least some basis in some kind of a generality somewhere along the line, and they're definitely
Jackson was also a Mason.
As were almost all of the early founders.
Yeah, there was a kind of a mania for that kind of thing. Well, it's funny, you know, I when I joined the, I decided I wanted to like help out of the parish. So I said, what can I do to help out of the parish? Well, the Knights of Columbus, that's, you know, they're the guys that do the Mardi Gras thing and the Oktoberfest thing. And here's the family that needs moved. And so they go and they help do that. And they, you know, all those kinds of the pancake social guys and all that. So I thought, I'll join the Knights of Columbus. Well, the Knights of Columbus are just, they crack me up because and we'll be back right after.
Redbox Media now is a great way for you to go deeper with your favorite show or shows in our programming lineup. With our Friend of the Show opportunity, you get extra exclusive content from your favorite show hosts and lots of extra love from the shows and hosts you love. Become a friend of the show by clicking on the link on our website or app menu. Your $10 monthly premium membership will unlock an exclusive world just for you. Support your favorite show today as a friend of the show. Friend of the Show premium memberships exclusively for you with Redbox Media.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here. What were we talking about before the break?
You were in the middle of something, and now.
Oh, the Knights of Columbus. Yeah, that's right. Well, see, the thing is, starting in the 18th century and beginning with things like the Masons, and there were other organizations as well, there grew up this mania for secret societies. People just loved these things, you know, and it kind of harked back to, you know, the idea of a guild and so on and so forth. But, you know, of course, all guilds were was just, hey, you're a stonemason? Me too.
Although they did sort of acquire all the trappings of a religious order or college football.
Yeah, well, sure. And we tend to do that. I mean, it's funny, you know, we sort of, you see that in any organization. It has its rites and rituals and so forth. I mean, the Scouts, you know, the Cub Scouts, the Boy Scouts have little rites and rituals that you do. And your crossing over ceremony and, you know, here's our special handshake and this kind of thing. People just went nuts for this in the 19th century.
Right.
And then, of course, once you've constructed the group with its special set of rules and stuff, those who are on the outside wonder what they're doing in there.
That's a good portion of the appeal, you know.
No, yeah, that is, and it's so funny because
What was the name of the lodge that that Ralph and Ed belonged to in the Honeymooners?
Was it the Water Buffalo?
Maybe something like that. The
Water Buffalo Lodge or something.
So yes, it gets spoofed pretty good in that.
Yeah, and it's funny because so a number of these organizations, for example, the Ku Klux Klan, the Know Nothings, the Know Nothings got their name because they were told if anyone asks you, you know, what you do, just tell them you know nothing.
That's right.
And their enemies very quickly said, yes, that's true. You know,
good description.
But the irony of these organizations so often is that they had a picture of the Catholic Church that was really kind of a mirror of themselves. They figured that the Catholic Church, you know, God alone knows what those Catholics are doing in their secret rites and ceremonies. And partly it was helped along by the fact that our rites were in Latin.
Right.
And Latin, as everybody knows, is the language that you always use to cast spells or
as J.K. Rowling has reminded us recently. Yes,
right. Latin is, it's the language, you know. I watched a movie called Cabin in the Woods, which is a spoof of every horror movie you've ever seen, written by Joss Whedon, and at one point I won't go into the plot. And by the way, if you don't have a very substantial tolerance for lots of gore, don't watch this movie. But at one point, you know, it follows all the conventions that horror movies do. And so, of course, at one point, you find the book that's got the Latin spells written in it.
And you should never read aloud.
Never read that aloud. Everybody knows that, right? Because Latin is, you know, Latin is all terrible things from Latin. And but that was the irony, of course, of the great anti-Catholic secret societies of the 18th and 19th centuries, is that they attributed to the Catholic Church what they themselves did, which was this hyper secretiveness. And, you know, special lingo and so on and so forth. And the irony, of course, when you get into the Catholic Church, is like everything is all out in the open. There aren't any secret rituals. It's just, you know, I mean, there are rituals that are private and respected. But even those, you know, so
baptism. Well, an additional element in this. And, you know, I mean, I don't want to stick my neck out too far because obviously these things by their very nature are surrounded with mythology and conspiracy theories and all that. But it does seem that the reason the church took a special concern with Freemasonry mm-hmm. is that it does seem to have been at the highest levels amongst people like Jefferson and people like that. It does seem to have been deism's attempt to create an alternative to the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it whenever we've gotten anything like a non-hysterical accounting of what it's really all about, all of the secrets of the 33rd order and all the rest of it, it does seem to involve some sense that if the world would bring forth a purified version of Christianity, mm-hmm. more pure than the Puritans were willing to purify, and mm-hmm. take things just down to the simple idea of an intelligent creator God who wants all men to be brothers and all of that, sort of the stuff that Robespierre was pushing in his Cult of the Supreme Being. There does seem to be some reason to believe that at its core, that's what Freemasonry was intended to be, that it was intended to gradually become the Church of Humanity when humanity had completed its dropping of all of the external barnacles that surrounded Christianity. And this, I think, is the reason that the Catholic Church took an interest in it. So there's a third level in there. In other words, yes, there's the Moose Lodge and the Elks Lodge and all these other things. But the reason it's interesting that Washington and all the others were all, I mean, some fully half, I think, of all American presidents have been Freemasons. Without bringing conspiracies in, right, and without imagining that every person who's involved in the lodge either knows about or would agree with this goal. It does seem to have some,
That's often my, when I look at stuff like that, it's like, there's this funny belief that some people have. You run into this with fundamentalism, that if you so much as have anything in your house that's like tinged somehow with paganism, somehow it's like radiating this magical occult influence that's gonna do something terrible to you. This is something you see in like science fiction or fantasy movies especially.
Well, and the Apostle Paul seems to go specifically out of his way in the book of 2 Corinthians to say these gods are no gods at all, so they right. can't hurt you.
But the notion though that the amulet that you brought back from Africa is somehow going to you see those
makes a great Twilight Zone episode.
Oh yeah, it makes a good Twilight Zone. Somehow or other, it's gonna do something. Right. And exactly, what's so funny, of course, is that the reality is that people can call themselves Masons or whatever, and have just as intense a relationship with Masonry as Madonna has with the Catholic Church. I mean, she was baptized once a long time ago, not having a big impact on her these days,
it's another thing that's interesting about all of this is that if you read Jefferson and Adams's letters to each other, Jefferson raised an Anglican and remained an Anglican, very liberal Episcopalian all his life.
Right. Right.
And Adams, a Unitarian, which had become sort of the norm for educated New Englanders by that time.
Right.
They have long discussions in their letters when they're friends again late in their life. They have long discussions about Christianity and about the defects of Christian theology. Mm-hmm. And almost all of the things that they hate and repudiate in it, they repudiate as Christianity. When really what they're hating and repudiating 9 times out of 10 is Calvinism, which is pretty much, it's 17th century Church of Englandism is what they hated.
Yeah.
And all of the things they debunk and all of the, Jefferson at one point says, I think the Christians give a great handle to atheism with their arguments that God can't be known or understood except from Scripture.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Now think about that.
The Roman Church would agree with you on that.
Yes, the First Vatican Council explicitly says that God can be known and at least partially understood without Scripture. But right. of course, he didn't know that. Even though he predated the Vatican Council, this was an old teaching of the Church, that human reason is sufficient to learn many things about God. I'm following in the footsteps of St. Paul. But one of our most brilliant, two of our most brilliant men were able to make this statement and they weren't aware that they were attributing to quote unquote Christianity something that was exclusively the property of Calvinism. And it's because Calvinism and Christianity were synonymous to the 18th century Englishman in reaction to 17th century Anglicanism.
Right.
Which is what these guys both were.
Yeah, you know, one of the more interesting conversations I had with an Anglican bishop, actually, in Australia. And he was the one that pointed this out to me. I had not really thought about this before. But he said, one of the things that's worth noting is that the loss of Marian piety was a rather late development for English Protestants. It certainly didn't happen with Henry's break with the church. He says, it really seems to have begun with Elizabeth. And we'll talk about that when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we're here today with Rod Bennett, and we'll be back right after this.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Rod Bennett. If you want to join us, give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. And you can also tweet us at Breadbox Media. We were talking about something before the break, and now my mind, as is often customary, is a blank.
We were engaging in sort of a free-formed gallop through American and European history.
It's true.
But as to what exact point we were on.
Okay.
Does our esteemed producer perhaps have a better memory than either of us?
Ethan knows. Ethan wasn't listening. Ethan is not there.
You can hardly blame him, can
you? Oh, I'm just drawing a blank. I was going to go somewhere before the break, but not for what it was.
I distracted him.
You dazzled me with your rapier wit and your...
Something, anyway.
Dizzying intellect.
Oh, so, my goodness.
Okay.
Well, this would be a good time for a phone call.
Okay. Maybe somebody out there was listening and paying attention to what we were talking about. I don't even know.
Waiting with bated breath to hear the rest of it.
There's no one there.
Oh, boy. American history. Seems like we were talking about, Freemasonry.
We moved on past that. I forget. Yeah, anyway, it doesn't matter. That's all right. It was having a free ranging conversation like a chicken, but
that's right.
But without
I mentioned that fully half of our presidents have been Freemasons, and I think probably you have to have that to get by at the Yale Law School and all the rest of it. That's probably as much as it means for most of them.
Yeah,
in spite of what the conspiracy minded might have to say. But yeah. There's probably, at least in the case of one or two of them, some reason to think that they may have been devoted to the ideals of Freemasonry in the abstract, the idea of deism, the rest of promoting it.
It was one of those things that concerned the church a lot more, I think, in the 19th century than it does today.
There was a sense that Catholics were being ensnared into something and made to take irrevocable vows they couldn't go back on when they learned or later on about what the thing was really all about.
Yeah.
And that probably was not without validity.
Yeah. I'll probably hear probably hear about this later from people telling me that masonry is like a much bigger deal and I need to be very afraid. But, you know, my brother's father-in-law was a Mason, and it seemed to be sort of, how should I put it? He was not a member of Hydra.
Yeah,
kind of a nice guy.
I don't do conspiracy theories.
If
this stuff, for one thing, I've noticed that hardly any of these people that are into conspiracy theory, hardly any of them pick one conspiracy and stick to it. They've got 7 or 8 mutually incompatible conspiracies that they entertain all at the same time. The one thing that they know for a fact isn't true is the standard view of American history and what's going on in the world. That they know for a fact is wrong. Mm. So I don't do conspiracy theories. Considering the fact that all of the conspiracies that are the most damning right now are completely out in the open, they're making no attempt to hide what they're doing. Yeah. So... I mean, could the invisible ones do any more harm than the ones that are fully visible and making no effort to conceal what's up?
Yeah, it's true. It is kind of amazing, you know, when you it takes you back to Trump, you know, you look at somebody like Trump and think, you have that sensation of, you know, I can see that he's right in front of me on this television screen. Other millions of people are seeing this. But nobody seems to be upset by it or think that there's anything amiss. And how can that be, you know?
Right. That's hiding in plain sight.
Yeah. So, yep. I remember somebody, who was it? Chuck Colson remarked, you know, one of the reasons that he found the resurrection narratives so persuasive was because he knew what it was to actually belong to a large conspiracy.
Oh, run by the most powerful man in the world, really.
Yeah, and he said, you know, when things started to get hot, and nowhere near the hot of we're going to crucify you kind of hot, but merely you're going to go to jail, you know, for a little while. He says, you know, the whole thing just fell apart instantly, and everybody was running for their lawyers. And because, of course, we
kept it together for about 4 weeks, I think he said.
Yeah. Because, you know, if you're a selfish dirtbag, you don't think to yourself, I'm willing to take one for the team. You immediately run away. And so he found the whole, you know, argument that the apostles stole Jesus's body and the whole thing was a big fraud. He said, I've actually been involved in an illegal conspiracy, and I know what real illegal conspirators act like, and they don't act like the apostles.
Right. Right. Man. And that's a memorable stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. So I watched recently, I was watching I lived through Watergate, as did you, and but I was at the age where it was like, what? This on TV again all afternoon?
Bring back Lost in Space. Right?
Yeah, I was like, when is this going to end? This is just endless, you know, go away. And the Watergate hearings just dragged on and on and on, and I was in my teens, and I was like, Nixon's a crook, but I really am not interested in any of this, you know. And but it was fascinating because I watched.
To me, I think that this may be a rabbit trail here, but I'm fascinated with these things we call decades. How decades seem to have a spiritual cohesiveness. You know, we talk about the 60s, the 70s. It's the 80s, you know.
Yeah.
Often the decades spiritually don't exactly line up with the calendar. They don't start on January 1st, 1960, right, and end on December 31st, 1969,
right,
or 1970, if you want to be pedantic.
Yeah.
Actually, you might argue, and I probably would, that the 60s started with the Kennedy assassination and ended in August of 1974 with Nixon's resignation.
I think that's about right.
But I think the long before Nixon actually resigned, Watergate became a container for people our age or maybe just a little older for keeping the 60s alive. They started realizing somewhere about 1970 or so that the thing was coming apart, you know, like Dennis Hopper at the end of Easy Rider saying, "We blew it, man."
Yeah.
The thing started coming apart, and for nearly 4 years or maybe 5 years, the only thing that held it together was the common goal of bringing down Richard Nixon.
Yeah.
And I remembered the day he resigned and everybody suddenly got everything they wanted and the 60s dried up and blew away that day.
Yeah.
Because we looked around and realized that was the only thing we'd had in common for some time.
Right.
And and that was over at that point. And at that point, bring on the disco, you know.
Yeah, it was a strange period, you know. It's funny. I mean, as I'm getting older now, of course, you start looking back on your life a little bit and thinking, what was I doing while those things were going on? You know, again, young at that age.
Well, my experience was a little different than yours because most of my friends at that time, or a good number of them, were, you know, countercultural people, heads of various types. So, I mean, I was like 14, but it still had been following it blow by blow for quite a while. And,
okay.
That was at least the experience of a 14-year-old.
Yeah.
On the day that Nixon resigned. Realized that my older hippie type friends were just going to go off and get a job somewhere after that because
mission accomplished.
That was mission accomplished. And then the whole thing was over, you know?
Yeah.
And so anyway, maybe I've made people mad on this broadcast. I don't know.
No, I don't know.
But
yeah, it's curious. You know, the last decade clearly started
with 9/11.
Yeah. It started on September 11, 2001. Before that, you know, you look at the stuff that I remember Jonah Goldberg remarking, you know, in a column that he wrote, like right after 9/11, he's going, you know, last week we were talking about, you know, Social Security lockboxes, right? It's like, it's just gone. Nobody's talking about that anymore.
That's right. Know? Yeah.
And
the very, I would say that, the 70s ended the day that Ronald Reagan took office because it was the same day that the hostages in Iran were released.
Yeah, I would argue that that's true. Yeah.
So that's the era of what Jimmy Carter called malaise.
Yeah.
Came to an end that day, for better or for worse. And then I think probably the 80s probably ended. Oh, I don't know. Maybe when Bill Clinton took office. I don't know.
I think the 80s ended when the Berlin Wall came down, and when the Soviet Union dissolved. Really,
yeah, that's probably a good choice.
Yeah, that was it, and then it was on to a decade of triviality and prosperity.
Yeah.
Well, you've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and you've been listening to me and Rod Bennett yakking it up. And I will be back tomorrow with Christine Franklin. Until then, have a lovely evening. Bye-bye.
So long, everybody.